Next up, you're going to hear This Week in Law. Today, we're talking game intellectual property, phone location privacy, lots and lots about drones and robots policy and law relating to them, and smartphone locking laws in California. We've got Michael Frumkin, Padre SJ, Evan Brown, and me all coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 273, recorded August 29th, 2014. Self-suing cars. Help support TWiT with your Amazon purchases. Visit twit.tv/Amazon, click on the Amazon banner, and shop as usual. It doesn't cost you anything, and it helps support TWiT. That's twit.tv/Amazon. We thank you so much for your support. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and I am so thrilled that you're joining us this week for This Week in Law. We've got a spectacular panel of folks and some really interesting topics on deck. So let's get right to it. First, I'm going to welcome my co-host, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Good to be here. Hey, did you see Padres with us today? How awesome is that?
I did, and it is beyond awesome. Hello, Padre SJ.
Hello, TWiL folks. It's so nice to be here for this hostage exchange. You were on TWiT, so you know now it's time for me to reciprocate.
That's right. We had to bring you across many borders and through several earthquakes to join us today. But it's great to have you. For anyone who somehow has missed Father Robert Ballister in your life to this date, allow me to bring you up to speed. He hosts TWiT This Week in Enterprise Tech on our network, in addition to Coding 101, Padre's Corner, and Know How. So we're thrilled to have him, and all of those shows are wonderful. You can catch Evan and I on a couple of episodes of TWiT, just one. Really great to have you joining us here on TWiL. I think this is your third time?
Strangely, it's been a while. It's been quite a few months since the last time, but I'm not a stranger to TWiL.
No stranger. Someone who has heretofore been a stranger to TWiL as far as appearing on the show, but not a stranger to us as far as our following his work and fascinating conferences and other things that he's involved in, is University of Miami law professor Michael Frumkin. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Great to see you. Great to have you on the show.
Oh, this is great. Thank you so much.
We're so thrilled you can join us. Michael is a very, very busy man. You might remember back in April when we were following along avidly with the doings at the We Robot Conference, which is the annual conference on robots, law, and policy. Michael organized this that conference and is the founder of that conference, correct?
That's right. Of course, Miami is such a big center of robotics, we had to have a conference.
That's right. Of course it is. I always suspected that those people on the beach weren't quite real, so that explains much. Michael is also the Lori Silvers and Mitchell Rubenstein Distinguished Professor of Law at University of Miami.
Do you know who they are?
No, who are they? Do you
know, they're the founders of science fiction cable channel.
Oh, how awesome. Hmm. What a, of course,
isn't
I would always say
that. Isn't
that
a great chair to have for a technology lawyer? It's wonderful.
It's perfect. Has taught internet law, teaches a lot of nuts and bolts law classes in addition to IP in the digital era, internet governance, law and games. And we have a pretty interesting topic along those lines today. E-commerce, and of course, is really interested in robots, law, and policy. So we can't imagine a better fit for our show, and we're so thrilled you could join us.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So let's start out. Let's see what's up with Twitch and talk about a copyright issue that they have been facing. Oh. So some really interesting stuff going on with Twitch. I will start at square one for anyone who thinks that I'm having some sort of speech tic or is not familiar with Twitch. They are a video channel that, Padre, help us with the history here. Weren't they part of Justin TV originally?
Right. So it was a spinoff from Justin TV, which, of course, was at first an experiment to put someone's life on the internet. Mm-hmm. They decided that they wanted to go in a slightly different direction. Rather than just allow people to live stream their lives, they wanted to have a specific focus, and that focus that they picked was gaming. So Twitch is a place where gamers of any genre, it doesn't matter if you're doing role-playing or if you're doing speed runs, if you do console gaming, PC gaming, can stream their gaming session along with a little video of themselves live. And you'd be surprised how many people actually watch these streams. And millions of people at any given time are watching people play Minecraft or World of Warcraft or Diablo. And it's actually kind of addicting. I will admit to spending more than a few hours watching someone else play a video game.
Right, and it's also educational. I have a 10-year-old who loves Minecraft, and he doesn't watch TV anymore. He's never heard of Twitch, and I'm not sure I'm going to tell him about Twitch because I've already lost him to several dozen YouTubers who do this kind of thing. And he watches it so he can play better in the games. He's getting pointers from professionals kind of thing. And these people are professionals. They're monetizing these streams of themselves playing videos, putting very high volume of this stuff out and making money off ads and donations, I trust. So, and some find some really interesting ways to monetize where they, particularly with Minecraft, where you can build so many additions and augmentations onto the game. There are whole servers and things that you can join, and you get special things at the server if you pay extra money. And the YouTube channel is, the marketing platform for that. So people are making money doing this, but there are a few issues. Evan, you first pointed me toward, I think, in your Twitter feed, the fact that Twitch was having a content ID kind of issue where their content ID system was automatically removing audio from some of their videos and some very high-profile videos, some gaming tournaments that were going on. So this was very, very bad. They took a lot of flack for this. Do you have anything you can add to what happened there?
Well, this was all, it was an interesting context for it because this was all early, the early part of August. I guess it's still August, right, as we're filming this earlier, the first couple weeks of August, when there was a lot of discussion, what's going on with Twitch? Is Google going to buy it? And is it going to be subsumed under the YouTube brand? And, since then, we've learned, that Amazon bought Twitch for $970 million. So there was this little transaction going on here. So it's sort of interesting to see that there was a little bit of housekeeping going on here. This and it bears emphasizing, I think you said this already, this copyright controversy. And really what the controversy is sort of just this dissatisfaction. Outrage may not be too strong of a word, that users of the video on demand service, not the live interactive part of Twitch, but when people would upload themselves doing playthroughs of video games and having either ambient music or actually music laid down as a track with it, there were the Twitch became a lot more restrictive about that, a lot more less lenient, I guess is probably the better way of saying it, and was muting large portions of tracks that were identified, and the technology was Audible Magic is what was going on here. So what was his name? Emmett Shear, the CEO of Twitch, did an AMA on Reddit and sort of summarized some of these things and essentially apologized for not giving the user base more advanced notice of the fact that there was going to be these greater restrictions here. So there's one part of the story is sort of the outrage, and then we can look at it and say, well, really, Twitch was doing its best to comply with the law, and it was doing perhaps a better job, you know, to that end, was doing a better job of complying with the requirements to meet the safe harbor, to sail its ship into the safe harbor under Section 512 of the Copyright Act, the DMCA. And then there was just also this interesting to see how it's played out historically. All this was going on in preparation for the closing of the deal, which ultimately turned out to be with Amazon. So several different angles to look at it from here, and several different interesting things to see go on, and us as you know, copyright enthusiasts can sort of recognize it's very difficult to be compliant, especially on a huge platform like this.
Right, and the larger issue besides the audio tracks, even if you're not adding any additional audio or other copyright and perhaps non-licensed material to your videos, just having the playthroughs is controversial in its own right. And lo and behold, we have a law professor who teaches a course on law and games. So Michael, I'm wondering what you think about this whole universe of people who are making, whether they're educational or entertainment oriented videos about playing video games and including the playthrough video in there. I mean, some of these games are actually designed with a recording feature built in, as I understand it. So it's almost hard under that circumstance to argue there's not some kind of implied license. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It depends what they put in the terms of use, right? I mean, they may say, well, you can record it for yourself, but you can't broadcast it. So, you know, if it wasn't in the terms of use last week, it's going to be in there next week. Mm-hmm. So I don't teach copyright. At least when, I don't teach it when I can't avoid it, but you can't avoid it. And as I was listening to this, I was just thinking about it sort of as law professors do in two completely different ways, right? One is, what is the law actually going to be? And the other is, what would the sensible law be like? And of course, with the DMCA, there ain't that much relationship between the two things. So if we start with what the law is going to be, the first thing that I thought about was songs, right? So if you write a song and I sing it, everybody understands there's a copyright issue there. But if I do a cover of your song and try to sell records, we don't have a problem with that. Well, how is a walkthrough really different from a cover? In a sense, the game is the song.
Mm-hmm.
And the walkthrough is the interpretation. So, and you know, and it just shows you how our instincts about copyright our popular instincts about copyright are so different from the way the law is likely to think about things.
Yeah.
Because legally, there's a pretty darn good chance that the law is going to say this is a copyright issue. Now, the next question is, does that make any sense? Right? Why are the people being harmed? Right? In fact, you know, I think the smarter, more enlightened folks who sell these games are going to want to encourage walkthroughs because it builds a community, it builds demand. And while there are a lot of people who obviously follow along in these walkthroughs, a walkthrough is not a substitute for playing yourself. It's a very different thing. So, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, it's a sensible rule economically, but I think it is the rule.
I
absolutely agree with you on the second part, which is the more forward-looking companies, the more forward-looking studios are looking at this and saying, this is actually good. We want people to see our game. We want our game to get exposure. We want people to be wowed by the visuals so that they play it. On the first part, however, one of the difficulties that we're running into when we try to upload this content is a lot of these studios are saying, it's not really a game anymore. This isn't Pac-Man. This isn't Centipede. More and more of these games are interactive cinematic experiences. You play to a certain point and you trigger a cinematic, and that cinematic will be the same for everyone. So once you get to that cinematic, I don't think there's any longer any discussion on whether or not it's a performance or if it's a replay. It's
right.
Absolutely a replay.
And so, the same thing with the audio track, if they're playing music in the background, same
right,
problem.
Right, right. So, I mean, and this is what's kind of baffling me about Twitch. I understand why they did this. They were clearing house because they knew they were going to get bought. They ended up getting bought by Amazon rather than by Google. And there's a lot of comparisons between this and the acquisition of YouTube. Back when YouTube was acquired, so many naysayers were saying, well, how are you going to monetize this? All it is a bunch of copyrighted content that people have uploaded, especially a lot of anime and stuff that belonged to Viacom. Well, YouTube was able to claim safe harbor because they said, no, that's not the purpose of the platform. The purpose of the platform is for people to upload their own content. Those other people are abusing it. And they were more or less successful with that strategy. Twitch is different. They do nothing but upload content that is copyrighted. They do nothing but upload content that's going to be challenged by game corporations. I don't see the same safe harbor argument. They can't say the platform's being misused. That's what the platform was built for. So even though I'm with you, I believe that the smarter companies should see this as a good thing. We already know Nintendo is going to go after anybody who uploads any gameplay from their games. And if Twitch is anything like YouTube, those pieces of content are going to get pulled down.
And it's a big target.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially now, you know, if that's the price tag, that means it's a really big target. That's lawsuit bait.
Right. And it's a target on a couple of fronts, right? Because you've got the site itself that is the larger target, monetizing all of its individual users uploading these videos. But the users are, you know, making a living at this too, or trying to. So there are a couple of potential avenues of pursuit if you're someone in the market to bring a copyright lawsuit. Michael, do you think that you're talking about the law as it is and the law as it should be? Are we going to see any reconciliation here? I mean, clearly there...
Huh? Yeah, sorry. No, I mean, big copyright's got the cards here, right? They've got the rule they want. They've got some of them are embedded in international conventions or in interpretations of international conventions. Why would they want to compromise? Because, you know, from their point of view, having a strong background rule is perfect, right? If they want to waive it, right, if it's one of the enlightened companies, they can do that under the rules. They've got all the cards. They've got all the choices. So especially in this political environment, where getting anything through Washington is really, really hard, I don't think there's much hope for change.
All right. On that sad note, we can just this is just to note in passing an interesting stat from YouTube, not just YouTube, but across Google. From Torrent Freak reported on this, but Google itself put its numbers out as part of its data transparency efforts. It's being asked now to remove over a million items every day for copyright infringement. So the volume has just ramped up exponentially. Someone did the math.
Well, I wish that said allegedly pirate.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's I think that's Torrent Freak's headlines that says 1 million pirate links per day. It's funny that they embrace that terminology. But they write, to put these numbers in perspective, Google is currently asked to remove an infringing search result every 8 milliseconds compared to one request per 6 days back in 2008. So clearly people are putting the DMCA through its paces. Evan, what do you think this means?
Oh, well, I just thought they didn't say allegedly pirate because these were like Pirates of the Caribbean and, you know, Pirates of Penzance and stuff like that. But well, those are staggering numbers. Did you already say it? That's one every 8 milliseconds or something like that?
Yes.
Is that what it is? And compared to, you know, just one every few days in 2008 or something like that. So extraordinary numbers. I mean, clearly there's what we're seeing is a greater or use of more sophisticated technologies going on here, both to scour the web, the part of the web that can actually be scoured. This isn't even considering the dark web, presumably, because then it wouldn't be showing up in Google in the first place. So that gives us a sense that this might just be the proverbial tip of the iceberg, or the tip of the proverbial iceberg. I'm not sure which. So, you know, we see greater...
Can I interrupt you for a second? Why are they scouring the web? Aren't they just scouring Google?
Is there any part of the web that's not on Google?
Right, but I mean, one of the things I'm curious about is how they find the link. Do they find the infringing content and then look for it on Google to pull it down? No, they probably go through Google just looking for the links, and they automate that. And it would be really interesting. I mean, there have been a lot of anecdotal data about people making false DMCA requests. It would be really interesting, you know, if somebody could get a grant to take 10,000 of these requests and figure out how many of them were legitimate. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what the number would be.
I mean,
it could be very high.
I guess I'm conflating Google and the web, but I think that it would only make sense to think that, to the extent that they're sending Google notifications about links that are in the Google index, then it's what Google has indexed on the web, and, you know, not necessarily vice versa. I'm not assuming that Google has indexed the whole web, but I think it's safe to assume that most of it. So So there's just, I guess I'm just emphasizing the point. There's a greater amount of sophistication, not only on the scouring that's being done, but clearly it's amazing to think of what Google is having to do here in, I mean, that it would not be humanly possible without essentially conscripting the entire population of the earth to review all of these things manually, not only just to pull up the request that's being made, but then also make some evaluation as to whether or not this is or is not infringing content and make some thumbs up or thumbs down decision on whether it is something that might be qualified as fair use, for example. I'm just now remembering I spoke at a conference in 2006. This was right when William Patrie had just gone over to Google. He's, of course, the famous copyright scholar, and he very memorably said to the group that was assembled there that we're speaking to that Google does indeed look at DMCA takedown requests. I think in particular he was talking about Blogger, and makes a determination as to whether or not this might be infringing, whether it may not be infringing, whether it may be fair use. And so I suspect that that's no longer the case unless it's some very particularized situation. I can't even imagine what that would be. That would warrant, or that would, you know, be would get human review on the first round with these staggering kinds of numbers. So it's just amazing to think where this could be going if we're seeing exponential growth. If that growth is going to change, and these numbers here indicates a greater sophistication in the technology, it indicates more allegedly, as a nod to you, Professor, infringing content online. And so it's just, we're just going to have to continue to see a greater advancements in these things to keep up with the request. I think there's advancement both on the perception, you know, the finding of allegedly infringing content, and that has to be matched with equally powerful technology to meet all of those DMCA takedown requests.
The chilling effect of this on business must be just staggering. It would be interesting to find a way to measure that, although I don't know how you do it. If you're someone who has a good idea about becoming some sort of net intermediary, whether you're someone like Twitch or somebody else that's going to host content where users can be posting things that may have copyrighted material in them, you've got to build this into your cost of doing business. And I've got to think that it's just chasing away. It's got to be a staggering number of businesses. You know, this is a cost that would be, as Evan described, you'd have to conscript every human on the planet to actually thoroughly review this. Padre, do you think that this is having a huge chilling effect?
It can, but the DMCA safe harbor provision is actually pretty clear about who is and who isn't protected. So you have to have an agent that is listed to handle any DMC takedown notices. That much is clear. As long as you've got that, so that's already a cost. You have to have no knowledge of or financial benefit from any copyrighted material that may be hosted on any services that you're running. And you have to have copyright policy on dealing with non-copyright compliant material that may be hosted on your service. As long as you've got that, you've got a nice fallback to say, hey, I'm safe harbor. Now, we know from experience that that's not necessarily going to defend you, but when I write up acceptable use policies, the DMC safe harbor provisions are always in there. And I'm pretty sure that my acceptable use policies are standard. I've seen them in many, many different places. So is there an effect? Most probably, in that it changes that particular byline inside of an AUP. But is there a super chilling effect? We haven't seen it yet, just because the DMCA system is so broken and so clogged. And as Evan mentioned, it's going to get even more clogged that I think it will eat itself before really big business and really big enterprise networks are going to be affected.
Well, I suppose one thing we could do is teach robots how to review DMCA requests.
Yes,
and turn them loose. We'll talk about that in just a moment, but right now I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that's you. You folks watching, you know how you can help? You can help by shopping at Amazon. You're already doing it. I know you are. We all do it. And now you have yet another reason to consider Amazon in your arsenal. We've been talking about its purchase of Twitch. You already know the price selection and convenience of Amazon. Now you can actually support us here at Twit with your Amazon purchases. It's easy. What you need to do is go to twit.tv/Amazon. Just, you know, put it as a toolbar bookmark or however it makes it easy for you to remember, hey, I'm going to go buy that book or piece of music or piece of electronics. And instead of just heading straight over to the site, use our link. And when you do that, it costs you nothing extra, and anything you purchase helps keep the lights on here at the Twit Brick House and helps bring you our show and Padres shows and every other show on the network. So it's a real important thing just to remember. We know you're a fan. We know you shop at Amazon. So just do it. Just make it easy. There's so much great stuff that you can get there. If you're not already, you know, I am just so hook, line, and sinker a customer of theirs. I can't think of much that I don't buy at Amazon these days. So even if you're just the occasional shopper, it certainly helps. So whatever you buy, please make sure to click through on that Amazon banner at twit.tv/Amazon. It doesn't cost you a thing, and it helps support Twit. You can also bookmark that page and click through our link every time you shop at amazon.com. There are links there, too, if you're a person in the United Kingdom or Canada. That works as well. Use those links instead. Once again, twit.tv/Amazon. Thank you so much for your support of our network. Let's talk about robots and what they're able to learn. Was this at Harvard, Michael, that or am I getting my universities confused? No, we have some swarming robots that are the product of that institution. But we do have some robots that are learning from YouTube videos. Now, maybe they're learning how to play video games, since we know how many of those are out there walking you through. But no, this is Cornell, by the way, and they have created something called a RoboBrain, which is an extensive database of YouTube videos created by Aditya Jami. And it stores information in a robot-friendly format so that machines can pull from that database and learn how to do different kinds of tasks. We have a video playing, if you're watching our live video right now, of a robot being given some commands to make a bowl of ice cream. And it's actually doing a great job. I noticed it got a little drip on the counter, but I've got to say, I already mentioned I have a 10-year-old in the house, and the robot is being far more tidy than my 10-year-old is when he gets himself some ice cream. So apparently they're doing a pretty good job of walking the robots through learning these tasks. But Michael, you're a bit skeptical?
Well, it didn't tell us how it learned. I mean, for me, this is if they're really doing it, this is one of the most exciting stories of the week or the month, because we've already made a design decision for a lot of robots, and we want them to be human-like, because our entire constructed environment is constructed for featherless bipeds of a certain height and strength, right? So you want your robot to get in and out your door. It's got to be able to turn doorknobs. That's actually a fairly tough problem for a robot, because doorknobs come in all shapes and sizes. You don't want it to pull it off the door, but you want the door open. It's got to figure out which way the door goes and all the rest of it. So we're building these robots that are, you know, vaguely human-shaped, even though that might not be the optimum thing for every task, because it allows you to make them general purpose and fit in our environment. Well, our environment's really complicated. So, you know, the training and programming aspect of that, you've got to have robots that can learn. And if they can learn, if they really can learn from videos, and what was not clear to me was whether these videos were purpose-built by the researchers to teach the robot, or if they're just pulling them off, you know, from the web through some process. I mean, if it's the latter, right? If they're able to learn from videos that weren't designed for that purpose, then it's only a matter of time before we start having other programs sorting the videos to pull which are the ones which are good training and bad training. I mean, do we really want the robots learning how to use an Uzi? Maybe not. But now that just opens up a possibility of, you know, having robots be, in a sense, programmed by things that weren't written by programmers, just people going around their lives doing ordinary tasks. And that is a potential for a giant flowering of robot abilities. So I guess I'd say that even if these guys haven't figured out how to do it, someone's going to figure out how to do it eventually, and that's going to be a big deal.
Right. And you touch on an interesting law and policy point in this whole process. If we're going to teach robots in one way or another, crowdsourcing knowledge that they're able to get off the web, it certainly raises concerns about what it is they're able to learn and who they're learning it from, and what sort of parameters they're being given for carrying out those tasks.
If you're a lawyer thinking about robots, practically the first thing you think about is the guy who buys a general purpose robot, and he, you know, tells it, okay, go cut my lawn. And while he's at work, the neighbor starts teaching the robot, you know, stupid robot tricks. And that's nice and funny until he does one on the mailman and breaks his leg. And then figure out the liability for that. You got the neighbor, you got the owner who left it unattended, you got the people who built the robot, you got the people who sold the robot, you got the people who did the programming. It's what we call a target-rich environment.
The interesting thing about this is I really don't want the new generation of robots to be learning from YouTube. All they'll be doing is dumping buckets of water on themselves and kicking people in the nuts. But seriously, Victor, if you show that link that I've got, the university that's making this, they describe the learning process as the interpretation of natural language text, images, and videos. And this technology has been around for a while. It's kind of hit or miss. And if you scroll down, they try to describe the clues, the little bits and pieces that they're picking up from pictures and images that you see. For example, they can figure out the spatial distribution for working activity. So in other words, what does something look like when it's working? What does a person look like when he or she is working? It can figure out, oh, that's a part of a microwave that people interact with, and therefore that's a point that I should interact with. That's a point that I should manipulate. It can figure out things like, when there's a TV here and there's a human here and the human's at this angle, it means that the human's watching TV. That's all well and good, but the problem with learning from this type of activity is because not every microwave, every TV, every human, every device it might interact with works the same way, that natural learning has a natural stumbling block. The first time that the robot comes to a microwave that it hasn't seen, or a microwave that works differently than a similar microwave, it won't know what to do. So I think that's the limit of learning. Is it learning? Not really. It's learning mimicry, but unless it's actually seen that exact situation, it won't know what it's supposed to do.
The microwave example doesn't really worry me, because the microwaves are eventually going to have RFID chips or something that right. talk to everything else, and they'll tell the robot what model they are, and there'll be instructions built in. So, or at least it can phone home for instructions. It's right. probably what will really happen, right? It comes upon a new microwave, figures out what model it is, and it does what we do, right? It goes and gets the instruction manual online. It'll just be a roboticized instruction manual. Right. So that's not the exciting part. I think again, lawyers are probably trained to always worry about what can go wrong. Okay, so think about what's the majority of the stuff that the videos on YouTube are, you know, online are about. And then try to imagine if we don't have careful quality control for which videos a robot takes as input, then I think pizza delivery men are in real trouble.
I think a lot of this conversation is based on some assumptions that the knowledge of the robot, so to speak, and I guess I should probably put that term in air quotes, that the knowledge is somewhat static. This is all pre, I don't know if it's the same thing as the singularity, but it's all pre that point in time where robots do not possess artificial general intelligence, the ability to rationalize and think and learn with the same kind of sophistication that a human does, you know, to learn how to solve problems. So what we could see is this going a couple of different ways. Well, I can think of three different ways. One is robots encounter doorknobs they've never seen before, and they don't know what to do, and they give up. But that's still, you know, pre-AGI, you know, because a human can figure out how to open up a doorknob where it hasn't seen the shape before. The second could be is that once you get past the point of artificial general intelligence, then, of course, and this is I'm sort of being influenced by the works of James Barrett now. I'm reading his book, Our Final Invention. So a lot of these things are sort of have the availability bias, if you know what I mean, to think these things through. The robot is going to be improving itself and constantly getting smarter. So problem solving, in a short period of time will just be sort of a non-issue because it's so easy and so much the robot will contain so much greater capacity to solve problems on the fly than what we could even envision. But what's even more likely to happen is if these robots are networked, they won't even have to go through those quadrillions of cycles to figure it out in the local environment, but it'll just consult with the network and other robots somewhere else who has already figured out to open up this this door handle, and that's how it's actually going to be. And so that just sort of explodes these questions that you're talking about, Professor, when we start then thinking about where do we assign liability to that. You know, that's in high target environments, you've got then innumerable opportunities for you to assign the causation for what caused that, for example, the tort to happen.
I'm totally with you on option three as the likely option, right? I mean, the likely winners in the short and medium term are Watson-like robots, right? They don't have self-consciousness. It's not the singularity. They're taking a huge amount of data. They're finding correlations. They're finding solutions. But what I don't see is why the data from which they draw is likely to put any liability risk on the people who made that data available, so long as they didn't do so maliciously. Right? I mean, I'll never forget one of my kids back when he was in high school. I saw him once, you know, editing Wikipedia and said, "Oh, what you doing? This is great. My kid's public spirited. He's, you know, helping out. Well, you know, we have this game in school where we put fun stuff into Wikipedia, you know, just to see who'll believe it." Right? Now that's malicious. And so if people are putting up videos to trick robots into doing bad things, they're going to get liability. But if you put up a video for an innocuous purpose and the robot misuses it, I don't think anybody's going to suggest you're guilty of negligence. You don't have a duty to make your videos robot-proof. And I don't see one coming either. So I don't think that the distant third party is going to pick up any liability just because the robot listened to them. That's very different from the neighbor.
I see one thing. Like, for example, if we were really going to allow our robots to be programmed by what's popular, what's on YouTube, the things that most people watch and therefore have the most amount of authority. For example, if I told my robot, go make me a hamburger, and now it's searching through its database and looking for the most popular YouTube videos for instructions on how to make a hamburger, it's probably going to find an Epic Mealtime episode where all they do is make ridiculously dangerous and horrible things to eat, filled with Jack Daniels and 10 billion calories. And it's going to see that. And it's going to go, oh, okay, that's the proper way to make a hamburger. And I know that because that video has 80 million views. So I like this question of liability. There's no maliciousness, but yeah.
Apple robots are going to be popular because they're going to be inside a walled garden.
They're curated.
They're only going to curate, yeah. Right. So, curation, we're right back to one of the old divides we've had for years now, curation versus the Wild West. And maybe you'll have some robots will draw from curation and some won't. And it may be that running an uncurated robot, a robot that draws from an uncurated database, might be a higher risk activity.
Don't you think it's kind of naive, though, to think that you would have a robot that's powerful enough to go and watch a bunch of videos how to make a burger that hasn't somehow developed a sensibility about what's good in terms of its conduct? I mean, let's hope that that's been programmed in there. Again, I'm being influenced by James Barrett's thoughts on this. You know, has there been friendly AI programmed into that? Because if it's sophisticated enough to be able to figure out how to make a burger, it ought to know then the consequences of and the evaluative valence, or I guess it's a little redundant there, but you know the valence of choosing whether to put Jack Daniels versus just French's mustard on the thing.
Wait, is that even really a question? No, it's always Jack Daniels, right?
I hope it just knows not to put nails in there.
Yeah, actually. Well, but, yes.
Yeah,
I just hope somebody writes the rule that says the YouTube channel for Will It Blend is not in your database.
Go clean my iPhone, robot. Oh, no. What have you done?
It's clean.
It's got to be in there somewhere. All right. So they're learning either from videos or otherwise. There have been a few notable developments in artificial intelligence over the summer here. I thought I'd just toss them out and see if we want to talk about them. This study at the University of Reading, if I'm saying that right, in the UK, of a chatbot that passed the Turing test. It seems like we frequently hear about chat bots passing the Turing test. This one was named Eugene Goostman and was mimicking a 13-year-old boy so effectively that it fooled 10 out of 30 judges at the event, all of whom were scientists. So I have to go check out and see how Eugene portrayed himself or itself as a 13-year-old boy and see what little quirks were thrown in and see if it fools me. In any event, that has been in the news. Also in the news is how the Turing test is not necessarily what we should be looking at as the be-all, end-all for robotic intelligence. So maybe we can talk about that. What do you think, Michael, about this chatbot and the Turing test in general?
I'm trying hard not to make jokes about 13-year-old boys passing Turing tests. but what the control would be an interesting problem.
Yes.
So when I hear stories like this, what I immediately start thinking about is the work of Ryan Calo and people like that, who have been warning us with, I think, a lot of justice that one of the issues with robots is the extent to which people are going to trust them too much. Right? We may be hardwired, or at least partly wired, to trust things that look like people. And to the extent that we have robots that are going to look more and more like people or software bots that simulate, a person online, there's a real risk that once this technology of mimicry gets good enough, that firms and others are going to use it in ways which probably aren't helpful. And that can be anything from trying to sell you something to get information out of you, which would be a privacy problem. I've read a really interesting paper on police interrogation, which also touches on this, that, machine interrogation at the border might be vastly improved by putting on a human face on there, so people think they're talking to a person, and more likely to open up in ways that might affect their disability. I see somebody in the RSC said, "Trust me, I'm a human," but in fact, that's how our lizard brains work.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think absolutely. Those are the stakes. Those are the stakes here.
You've written a paper on the three laws of robotics. Are we able to put in enough checks in the programming that this isn't an issue, that it's okay for us to start to develop some trust?
Well, the paper was about the extent to which the legal system mimics the three laws of robotics, not the extent to which you can put them in robots. So I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the answer. I mean, if you're somebody building a product you're taking to market, you're obviously going to want to put a lot of safeguards in there so it doesn't hurt people. Because if it does, not only are you going to get sued, but it's really bad for business.
And it will probably already have been regulated in California to do it. It'll have been added to the cost of development. So just as a nod to another story that we're talking about.
Okay. Another interesting development over the summer. You may have seen the videos flying around, and that this was from Harvard, of the swarming tiny autonomous robots called kilobots. 1,024 of them working together and being individually aware of where they are in space and working together as a collective to make these cool shapes. And we've got a video of one playing right now if you're watching us live. So this is obviously an interesting approach toward robotics and their intelligence. Evan, you're reading James Barrett's book. Does the thought of swarming semi-autonomous robots give you pause?
Well, it does because of the sophistication, but I think there's a real optimism that one could have about it too, because isn't it fascinating to see how a lot of these systems mimic nature? And I'm not enough of a mathematician to be able to compare this to what we see with some of the principles underlying fractals. But I just think it's really fascinating to see the development of, in some instances, organic-looking shapes. And, you see these systems take on, forms that we recognize from just living in the world. It's probably the same thing going on that you see when you watch birds swarm or a school of fish, how they can take on sort of this shape and operate as an entire system. So it's fascinating to look at the sort of the fundamental essential principles that seem to be coming to life when you have these individual agents acting together to sort of manifest sort of a one a unitary intelligence. It's baffling, really.
I just read, I just finished reading a book by Daniel Suarez called Kill Decision. And the entire book is about swarm logic. And it got me into researching swarm logic. And it is one of the most useful pieces of programming that you can learn if you're going to be getting into robotics. The idea of building in the ability to accomplish great tasks with tiny little units, which, again, it's the basis of the insect's world. That's the basis of an ant colony. That's the basis of any lower animal colony. It's really groundbreaking, but it's also kind of scary. I'm not going to lie here. Swarms freak me out. And the ability to have a lot of these low-cost devices with a singular programming to accomplish a set goal, kind of scares me.
Yeah,
it's easy to find some sinister outcomes. Yeah, it's not hard to see where it could go bad. I mean, because swarming taking over. I mean, it could also be there could be a lot of good to it. I always envision a future where there are trillions or quadrillions of nanobots. Is that the second time I mentioned quadrillions in the show? There ought to be a prize for that. But where there are all these nanobots in the environment, and there's some sort of network that is occasioned by that, that could have a lot of positive uses, but then again could have a lot of negative uses too, especially if it gets across the blood-brain barrier and can infiltrate people's minds. So I can see where you're going, Padre, with that. It is daunting.
Well, perhaps. On the security research side, we've been trying to integrate swarm logic into some of these bot networks that that we've been playing with. And the whole idea is one of the powers of a swarm is there's no central control. You can destroy a large chunk of the swarm and it will continue to progress towards its goal. And so the idea was we needed to be able to defend against a bot network that had no set command and control node. Well, swarm logic is perfect for that because you can destroy most of it and it will still keep attacking. We've actually seen some of these attacks in the wild. The swarm logic is being used. It just hasn't made its way into a physical shape. But it's not a far jump to do that. And again, I'm getting all Terminator Rise of the Machines. But again, sure. I'm kind of freaked out.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, as Michael pointed out, it's easy to see the downsides of this kind of technology. Unfortunately, law tends to be kind of reactionary, so it would take something going terribly wrong before someone would pay attention. And then at that point, they might overregulate and quell innovation. But that just seems to be the pattern that we're used to seeing followed. Michael,
hey, that's unfair. That's unfair. I'm gonna try to defend the business.
Good. Go for it.
People get enthusiasm sometimes they make rules before technologies are even deployed. I mean, look at digital signatures, right? I mean, there was a solution looking for a problem in most of these statutes. So it really depends. I mean, yes, when you have a really big high-profile disaster, that does produce often excessive legislative response, but that's absolutely not the only way it works. I mean, if you look at the number of people we're thinking about robots right now and trying to design rules, in fact, that's why we started with the We Robot Conference, was to try to get ahead of the curve, to do a better job than we did with the internet. Right. On the internet, the DNS grows up based on various technical choices, which were not inevitable. They were convenient. And then we wake up one day and we realize we built a system that just does not mesh with trademark law at all. And there's all this fighting that happens for 15 years, right? The domain name wars could completely have been avoided by a different architecture. And the idea was, let's try to figure out where those problems are for robots and either design around them or change the law so those problems don't happen. And it's a higher stakes thing with robots because robots, it's a lot easier for them to reach out and touch you. So we get people's attention that way. But I don't think it's inevitable that, the rules are always going to be badly designed after something goes wrong. You can get ahead of the curve if you work hard to do it.
Well, Professor, what are the legal challenges that you would set in the way of developers of robotics in order to get them thinking about the law? Because I'm more of an engineer. I'm more on the science side, the technology side. I just like to build. And I never consider the legal ramifications. That's for somebody else. I love this WEI conference because, yeah, maybe it's a good idea for the people who build things to actually get a 10-year time frame of if your creation grows into this, then you have to consider that. So what are the things that, say, a young robotics creator needs to know as he or she tries to build up, so let's say, swarm logic?
Well, it actually depends enormously on the kind of robot, because the law is so specific. I mean, if you're doing an ocean-based robot, it's completely different from a land-based robot. A swarm is probably going to be very different from a humanoid robot. Where's it going to be deployed? In the home, the office, the hospital, the battlefield? Very different sets of rules there yet again. So I can't give you a general answer. But I can tell you this. In setting up WeRobot, we absolutely felt we had to have very substantial participation from engineers and roboticists at every level of the conference, from the program committee, attendees, presenters, everything. And that was also the hardest part, because for so many people who like you, who like to build stuff, when they see a lawyer coming, they think one of two things. They think either root canal or, you know, my pocketbook is about to be picked. They absolutely, you know, they don't want to think about the legal stuff. And trying to convince people that it's in their own interest to become rules engineers, in part, to make sure the rules get engineered for their benefit, or that they can engineer around the rules, in the design phase, is really hard, because people design stuff and then you know, it's only when you get to the build and deploy that the engineers really start realizing there's a problem. And by then it's too late. You got a lot of sunk costs. So we're really, you know, the challenge is, you know, think about these things at the design stage. Hard to get people interested, because they don't see any money in it.
Yeah. Are there resources, Professor Frumkin, for people who are at the design stage, you know, or the other than retaining someone as knowledgeable as you to consult with them every step of the way? Is there something that, as you said, if they're running away from lawyers and just trying to discover this kind of information online, where should they go?
Boy, that, you know, anybody who tries to be their own lawyer has a fool for a client.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, this is not a self-help situation. It's just not a self-help situation.
Right. Well, clearly Google has lots and lots of lawyers, both in-house and outside of the Googleplex, who are helping them navigate the legal considerations of their self-driving car, which they are, you know, plugging away at. Most recently here in California, they hit a couple of road bumps, no pun intended, that may or may not make sense. I'm interested to get all of your opinions on why Google cars need to have a steering wheel, according to the state of California. Padre, was this a reasonable thing for them to do as they're simply testing the cars now?
It's reasonable because we're humans and we think that we need the ability to override the computers. Now, let me start by saying that's what I would want. If I had an autonomous vehicle, I would like the ability to take control back from the robot when I know the robot's going to try to kill me. No, not maliciously, but because it's going to do something stupid. However, if you look at the numbers, if you look at automation versus human driving or human piloting, whatever it's going to be, we pretty much know that putting driving in the hands of a relatively informed autonomous system is going to be far safer than any human driving at any given time. That's just how it works out. If I'm a human driving a car, I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing alone, and I only know what I can sense. If I'm in an autonomous vehicle, like one of Google's vehicles, which can figure out what other vehicles are going to do around it, it's always safer. And yet there's always that human element that says, no, I need to be able to take over because some programmer somewhere wrote a line of code that's going to interact very poorly with my environment, and for some reason my car will want to crash into a wall. Yeah, I'd love to hear from the professor about this, because this is a fascinating point of law when adding a steering wheel may actually increase the possibility of a fatal accident.
Well, okay, couple things. First off, right now they're just requiring them in the experimental cars, and as I understand it, they haven't made a ruling on production. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that the ruling on experimental cars is just a straightforward application of existing California law. There isn't an exception for cars without steering wheels. So if you're going to put a car on the road, it's got to have a steering wheel, because that's what the law says a car's got to have. So I have sympathy for the California officials here, who I think are just applying the rules that they got to work with. Now, in the long run, the question is, you know, how much of an analog override should there be for people? And I think I can't give you a good answer to that question until you tell me a lot of stuff we don't know yet about how the programming's actually been done for the car. Because when the Jason Millar, who's a recent doctoral, I think he just got his PhD up in Canada, has done some really interesting work, and in fact presented at the most recent WeRobot conference on this, about the extent to which ethical choices get hard-coded into things like autonomous cars. Right? There are going to be some situations where the car gets itself in the position where someone's got to get hurt.
Right.
And the question is it the passenger? Is it the driver? Is it the bystander? Is it the dog? You know, what is it? And either we hard-code those choices in, and then you're asking me, take out the steering wheel and just go with whatever some engineer decided in the abstract, and I don't know what that is. And the other thing I need to know is, what's this liability rule going to be? Right? If you take my steering wheel away, is that going to absolve me of any liability for what the car does? That seems like a fair trade. You leave the steering wheel in there, you know, maybe I'm going to have more liability. And certainly if I'm Google selling the cars, that's the result I want. I don't want to be the insurer for every car on the road. That's a lot of liability you have to carry. So now I'm the driver and I'm going to have the liability. Well, then I ought to have some way to control the liability. But of course, it also means I got to pay attention. It also means you can't just put the kids in the car and have them go to school, because you got to have somebody with a license in the car. So there are a lot of social choices we have to make. And I am also confident that in the long run, the autonomous cars will be safer than drivers. And I'll even go so far as to say they'll be safer than most Miami drivers today, because Miami's crazy. But in a mixed environment where not all the cars are autonomous cars, right? You have a mixed environment of autonomous cars and, you know, legacy cars and people jaywalking and all the rest of it. I don't know how confident I am about the signals. I don't think from what I understand about the testing that's been done, it's still pretty far from the conditions that true deployed autonomous cars would be under. There's a Google engineer riding along. There's a lot of stuff happening. And there's not a lot of them on the road. They're not interacting with each other. In the long run, yes. Getting there can have all kinds of interesting hiccups.
Evan, you were commenting on California's heavy regulatory environment for this kind of thing. Are you surprised that California lawmakers are saying they're actually working on rules for cars without a steering wheel and pedals?
Well, it's no surprise that the regulators are giving attention to that. And I sort of tack on to what the professor's saying there about the nuance of what's particularly going on here. It doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of new legislation going on the question, particularly of whether it ought to have a steering wheel. And clearly it is way too early for us to be developing too many rules with this, because of the relatively nascent nature of the technology and all the other factors out there, namely legacy cars. I hadn't actually heard that term, but it makes perfect sense. You know, the traditional human guided, human directed fossil fuel burning cars.
Yeah, get it up on the spot. You're welcome.
That's good. It's good.
Yeah.
The question of the steering wheel is just the first of several questions of its ilk. And I think it gets even freakier as we go down the road of thinking along these things. And it's suggested in the article that we were reading together before the show today. What about headlights? It's one thing, there's a certain sense of unease riding down the car without a steering wheel, but who's going to be the first to venture to travel down the freeway at 85 miles per hour with no lights at night, you know, shining the way? But, you know, presumably those wouldn't be needed. I guess it just is going to depend on the particular nature of the sensors, but likely not. It's probably going to be infrared, lasers, whatever else, you know, not getting input of data that's reliant on or that depends on the visible light spectrum. So that'll be weird to ride in darkness. And the other thing, you know, windows themselves. So there's a long way to go on this, but it really does. If we look at it is amazing how much progress Google in particular has made just in the last few years with these things. I don't think 10 years ago there was much to say at all, was there, in terms of the reality of self-driving cars? Maybe even as recently as 5 years ago. I've sort of lost track of the historical perspective here, but things do appear to be happening fast in this area. So it's exciting to see where things will go in the next few years, just alone.
Well, an interesting note on that, which is GM, Ford, and Nissan were all working on autonomous vehicles as far as 8 years ago. In fact, we saw a GM prototype about 5 or 6 years ago at CES. And all of them had the same capabilities, which is they had some sort of sensor array, LiDAR or IR or sonar. They had the ability to keep their own spatial station keeping, and they had the ability to talk to other similar vehicles to do like the tuck and roll. So imagine four of those vehicles all traveling very close together at the same speed, and they're traveling as a single unit. GM actually created something that could do that. I rode in it. Every single one of those projects died for one reason, and the reason was they didn't think the product would ever meet market because they never figured out a way that the law would work. How would liability be handled with an autonomous vehicle? And ultimately, that's what killed them. But they also said the same thing, which is if you had a city full of these vehicles, if you had nothing but these on the road, no mixed environment, it would be close to 0% accidents. If you had a system that was so in tune, I mean, talk about swarming logic, that all the vehicles in a city were controlled at the same time, and so there would never be something that's out of parameter, it would be the safest system ever. But there's no way to place a liability. Who gets sued if something goes wrong? Someone uses one of the vehicles in the wrong way. A passenger overloads something so that the system reacts. And again, I think this goes to the professor. This is something where I think law needs to step in to tell the manufacturers, as long as you do this, you're okay. Because Google's making big strides, but does anyone have any hope for this hitting the light of day as far as the retail market's concerned until Google knows that they're not going to get sued the first time someone does something stupid with a self-driving car?
Well, I mean, in the tech circles, people always want the law to make it as easy as possible to deploy the new technologies, because either we have shares in the companies, we're running the companies, or we just love the gee whiz factor. But people who do social policy really have to think about the bystanders who are going to get mowed down by these things. And it's not obvious that just because you've got a gee whiz car, you ought to have any less liability than somebody who's got a regular car. And so there may be an issue as to where the liability should lie, right? Maybe it's Google's, maybe it's the car owner. And we can have a debate about that, and we should, but a lot of it depends on how much control the car owner has, what promises, representations Google's making, right? The more the logic is taking the power away from the driver, the less sense it is to give the liability to the driver, the more sense it is to give the liability to whoever designed the logic. And if that is going to delay deployment of the cars, we really ought to be grown up enough to say good. We really ought to be grown up enough to say good, because the idea that the liability should just disappear is actually dangerous. Cars are really dangerous things. Right. Now, if we have wonderful centralized control, we don't allow legacy cars on the road. Pedestrians are only allowed to cross in the crosswalk and all the rest of these things. Or maybe they got to, carry a phone or wear a sensor to tell the car they're coming. And if they don't, we're going to say they assume the risk of being mowed down by something going 60 miles an hour in a residential neighborhood. We can have that rule if a Democratic legislature wants to give it to us, but I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime. And I'm really not sure it should.
Well, because, I mean, if the liability doesn't at least get severely mitigated, that programmer in a lab will never want to program anything. If I know that I may somehow miss a potential hazard that the car will run into, which is an absolute certainty because the potential problems are infinite, then I'm going to say, well, it's not worth it. It doesn't matter what I'm getting paid. The future liability is just not worth it.
Well, again, then you have to give control to the user. If the program is going to have all the control, the car is going to have no steering wheel, no brake, no kill switch, no nothing, and we're going to just put people in there who don't have driver's licenses, then you absolutely can't have the passenger have the liability because they don't have any control. That's not fair. Right, liability. One of the purposes of liability has a number of purposes. One is to compensate people who are hurt, but another is as an incentive to people to behave well. Right. So if people who have the decision-making power, so-called least cost avoider, have to be the ones who have skin in the game, or they have no incentive to be careful, and if it turns out they can't be careful enough, they shouldn't do it. Right. So this is always the free market story behind nuclear reactors. Right. If the people who built reactors were really subject to the liability they could potentially cause, they would never build them. That's why we have the Price-Anderson Act that caps the liability. Yep. I mean, all the nuclear reactors in this country are not built on free market principles.
Michael, is there some parallel in product liability law to a DMCA safe harbor? Are there steps that manufacturers can take that if they've jumped through certain safety and compliance hoops and something has managed to go wrong anyway, that they have some degree of protection?
Well, funnily enough, we had a piece about this at WeRobot. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated answer, right? Because product liability is divided into different pieces. One's design, another is production, and there are other bits as well. So basically, for the production part, if you have an error on the production line, you're going to be liable for it, right? If you just didn't make it right.
Right.
You know, I'm oversimplifying, but basically, you know, you got liability for that. Mm-hmm. And you make a business decision as to how much quality control you want to do and how much liability you want to bear. Design is a little more complicated. It's actually the subject of change at the moment about where the latest set of proposed law reforms, with something called the third restatement of products liability law, makes it a little tougher for plaintiffs to claim that something wasn't designed right. And they're going to have to show that an alternate design was possible at the time. Now, that's not the same as a safe harbor, right? There isn't somewhere you can like register your design and say, now you're protected, you're safe, everything's okay. But if you're careful, you reduce your liability.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's all we can ask for. We can ask for reduced liability to encourage the development of these vehicles. But you're right. You know, at some point, there has to be some skin in the game. And if you can release a product into the wild and say, okay, well, I followed all the rules, therefore, even if you find some horrific flaw in the design, you can't come at me, that's not an option either.
That's why there's another piece in the things that were on the list of developments this week, the case for considering robots as people. That mm-hmm. article made me mad. That article mm-hmm. really made me mad because it's completely, you know, ignoring the moral hazard. Like the moral hazard is people build this stuff and they don't have an incentive to make it, you know, behave well. So if you're going to put the liability on the robot rather than on designer, user, or somebody, that's a license to go out and build things that hurt people and deploy things that hurt people. And, you know, as somebody who already thinks corporations allow people to escape from too much liability as it is, right, the idea that corporations are people in every sense is not a good idea. Why you want to have robots be even more down that road than corporations? I mean, this is a line of argument that says we're not even going to just incorporate the robot. We're going to treat it as a person. So nobody else is responsible for whatever damage it does. I don't see the argument for that. I mean, I don't even see the appeal of that. Why would you want to live in a world like that?
So this article is at Quartz. It's called The Case for Considering Robots People, if you want to read through it and try and wrap your mind around it yourself. And everything we're discussing today, you can find at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/273 is our public topic list. So this has a couple of permutations, the liability side and also the, I would think, the rights side, right, Evan? As things begin to think more for themselves, where do you draw the line? If a robot is capable of being hurt and is capable of having emotional trauma.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's the near term thinking about this, and then there's the farther flung term thinking about this, which is much more interesting, because when we think about the near term, we think of like, oh, corporations and insurance and stuff like that, relatively dull stuff. And that's sort of what I think is the rub here with this with this piece on Quartz about just treating robots as people, as if they're a corporation, and then that limits the liability of whomever it is that has involved with that robot, whatever humans whose ends it is serving is somehow mm-hmm. limited in that respect. And I sort of wonder if maybe some of the concept is being lost in translation in the article, because it does seem a little bit too simple of a concept, and to the extent that it's oversimplified, it irritates Professor Frumkin. So there may be something going on there. But then there's, of course, the longer-term vision of once these entities become so sophisticated that they demonstrate intelligence, and this is the motif I bring up fairly often, you know, the ability to demonstrate consciousness and the ability to feel and be sentient. And at that point, it seems like we as humans, and I think our system of law is based in large part in a very old part of the brain that allows us to experience, when we think of rights, at least, and human rights and some of the loftier aspirations of what the legal system hopefully tends toward, it's based on sort of like a compassion and a sense of feeling. And if there is an agency or an agent out there, a system, closed system, whatever, a robot, for lack of a better term, that has the ability to suffer, then the question of rights and liability becomes very different. Because if that agent does have the ability to suffer, this is just, I'm sort of trying out a new thought here that after having spoken with Professor Krumkin on one of the bases of liability, getting people to behave, if that robot has the ability to suffer to suffer the consequences of having liability placed upon itself, then it would be a good idea to attribute liability to that conscious being so that it can conform its conduct in a way as to not face future liability. And that is if it's been programmed to actually respond to conditioning. A lot of what ifs. But just to summarize, I think there's the near term thinking of robots as people, which is much more like a Citizens United concept versus robots as people, as a much deeper metaphysical, I would even submit to say spiritual question that we need to ask ourselves.
So the robots as sentient entities talk often starts with animal rights. Right, because people who are focusing on the slightly less long term say we're going to get to a point where robots are going to have the self-consciousness that animals have and ought not to be mistreated for the same kind of reasons animals ought not to be mistreated. Reasons that go both to the effect the mistreatment has on the recipient of the punishment and also on the giver, which it can be quite negative to be allowed to hurt things that look like people or like animals. It may be harmful for people to do that, if only in building bad habits. But when we go to the long term, that's not an environment I spend a lot of time thinking about, because I really do think that the singularity is going to happen. It's a long way off. Maybe we wake up tomorrow morning and we're surprised, but the robot overlord sent us a message. But until that happens, I'm sticking to my idea. Are we going to have robot children? Is there going to be a period, after you turn on before the robot is considered a full legal person? What are its rights going to be there? If you want to take this metaphor, it takes you to all kinds of interesting places. But for me, that's something you think about after two scotches.
We will have robot children, and some of the robots will be underachievers, and they will disappoint you and insult you as they grow up. And then others will grow to be fantastic robots that will build robot empires. I think the analogy is complete. I like what Evan said, that the liability can be solved solved with this really simple thing of giving the machines consciousness. If you give them consciousness, if you give them the ability to actually consider complex moral issues, then they become liable and we can wash our hands of all of that. So if we could get right on that, that will make things easier.
Our robot prison population will be easier to maintain than the current human one. I'm going to go ahead and put an MCLE passphrase into this interesting discussion, hearkening back to our learning robots and things that are difficult for them to learn. Our first passphrase for the show is going to be difficult doorknobs. We put these phrases in the show in case you're listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit. We discuss some really interesting and I think complicated issues on the show, some new developments in the law and some yet to be developed areas of the law. So if you're interested in going to whatever oversight body that you have for legal or other professional education credit, we've got some information about that on our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find the This Week in Law show there. And it should help you out. We'll put one more of these in the show so you can demonstrate to whatever overlord wants to know that you actually listened or watched the show and got this wonderful content into your head. Before we
can I get a robot to listen for the catchphrase?
Yeah, we could definitely program one to just pull out the passphrases, I'm sure. Some other interesting robot stories. This was tweeted my way from Sleepless in VA, Sleepless in Virginia, I'm assuming that means. An interesting story about And you get these kinds of analytical stories about judges and things trying to apply. We were talking last week about trying to apply data analytics to the legal profession. And this particular one talks about the best and worst times to have your case reviewed by a judge. And it talks about human decision making and how judges obviously are subject to all the human foibles that we all face, and how, you know, little things like whether you've had an adequate breakfast, whether what your day is going like, can impact that decision making and give someone a worse result at a certain time than another. So Sleepless in VA's question to me was, if judges were algorithms and justice were truly blind, would we still have these problems? So I'll toss that as our little discussion kernel out to Michael and Evan and Padre. And first, Michael, do you think that we're close, at least for some kind of rudimentary, simple dispute resolution, to being able to plug something into an algorithm and have a result come out? And would that kind of result perhaps be better than a judge's who had not yet had her coffee?
So, like a broken record, funnily enough, we had a great paper about this at the latest We Robot. Somebody did a really good study about traffic laws and to what extent speeding enforcement might be roboticized. And of course, if you want to do that, you have to have an algorithm. And the first question is, what's the rule? And they had a bunch of different people. They asked them to design rules. And it turns out to be really hard. I mean, are you going to allow people to go? Are you going to say if you go 1 mile above the speed limit, you get a ticket? Are you going to allow people to go to speed to pass? What about emergencies? You know, there's tons and tons of issues. And, you know, these guys who are mostly roboticists and one lawyer in the group, I think we're really shocked at just how difficult a task it would be, how far we are from having automated law enforcement just as speeding in a way that we would consider socially acceptable. So the answer is that, you know, sounds great, but it's so hard. I mean, you know, the human beings are so complicated and making decisions is so contextual. And indeed, we live in a common law system, right, which is based on the whole idea that context is really important. So you can have algorithm-based systems as long as you're willing to have really bright line, cruel rules. When I was in law school, one of the catchphrases that was around a lot was that hell is a place where the rules of civil procedure are strictly enforced.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you look at law, we look for judgment. And judgment is, as the professor has said, it's incredibly complicated because it's not just a single thing. A police officer looking to make a traffic stop is going to look at, okay, velocity. Going to look at how is the driver driving? Does the driver look impaired? Is the driver driving on a wet surface? Is the driver driving hazardly? Is he surrounded by other people who may be hurt by his driving? So that's judgment. Algorithms don't give us judgment. Algorithms give us thresholds. Algorithms trigger when certain conditions are met. Now, that's complicated. Now, to take the other side, if you were to look at public sentiment at accepting algorithmic justice, that this part's pretty clear. There's a whole population of society that believes that they don't get justice, and they would probably embrace an algorithmic system. There's another part of society that maybe even subconsciously understands that they have a leg up in the way that justice works in the current system, that it's easier for them to manipulate. They would probably not like this system. I would love to see a test case, of course, not replacing what we're doing right now, but just developing a system that would look blindly at cases that are going through the system to see which decisions would not coincide with the decisions that a judge handed down. That would be, I mean, I would love to.
You have to code that. It's really tough for the kind of cases.
You'd have to code it. It would be incredibly difficult.
What I would want to do it, the tax laws.
Oh my gosh, I would not want to go through the tax code to code all that.
But it's more detailed than a lot of other things. I think it gives you more to work with. So at least for things that weren't incredibly complex transactions where there were really hard characterization issues.
Okay.
I say this. Yeah. No, maybe we could make it work.
I can actually see that.
It's draconian to begin with. It's not like anybody thinks there's a whole lot.
You just put the entire economy into a giant Leontief matrix, right? We're close to that with e-commerce now anyway, right? We'll have better economic forecasting. We'll be able to better control the money supply. And by the way, you'll get a tax bill at the end of the year and it'll be perfect.
Wait a minute. We already have algorithmic tax codes. It's called TurboTax.
You put in the data yourself. You can make it say anything you want if you massage the numbers.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
All right. Well, one final robot-related story, this one about drones, having to do with Disney patenting several different drone technologies to use within its parks. And before you start thinking of swarms taking down crowds of Disney goers, that's not what's going on here. They actually have some really interesting looking technologies involved here. It's amazing what people are doing with drones. The first one seemed, they all seem to have a production and presentation format. First one is flexible projection screens that the drones move into place so they can put on, you know, their in-air nighttime kind of spectacles. Let's see, the second one.
Balloons.
Yeah, balloons. Really crazy going on again with digital fireworks and other things. And then the final one is the balloon one, making super large puppets move around and seemingly walk. So with the drones controlling their limbs, you could imagine some sort of drone-y Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade coming at you. It just from the legal standpoint, the fact that Disney is patenting this technology, and who knows if they'll move forward with it, but the Imagineers have been busy. Are you looking forward to seeing drone-driven spectacles sometime soon, Padre?
No.
No.
I drone technology is fun. I flew a drone over to Las Vegas, and that I got some great footage. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we've been told, because it's still kind of, we don't really know what's allowed and what's not allowed, is just don't fly it over a populated area. Because these things do fail. They could fall out of the sky, and they could cause someone some serious bodily harm. So now Disney's going to fly a couple of dozen, maybe a few hundred of these things over incredibly densely populated areas of their park. Cool technology, but all technology fails. And right now, the only failure outcome of a drone that has a problem is it falls out of the sky. Am I excited to see it? Absolutely. I'm excited to see it in action. Would I be excited to see it while sitting underneath the display? No. No way.
Yeah.
Why is drones holding stuff up patentable? Why isn't it just obvious?
Actually, that's a very good question.
Excellent question. I'm assuming it's something more than drones holding stuff up. Maybe they're specially designed drones that are a novel concept that way.
So drones as entertainment, is that the patent? So yeah, actually now that you've got me thinking about that, I'm mm-hmm. kind of upset.
What do you think, Evan?
Well, I mean, a couple things. I mean, it does raise some interesting questions about the patentability, and I think we just got to keep it in mind here. There's always the tendency to try to read too much into these tea leaves. These are just patent applications. It may or may not be something that actually comes into fruition. I imagine Disney owns tons of patents, many, many patents. And just to comment on what you said, Padre, about the danger of all this. I mean, isn't that easy to overstate? Because we do all kinds of really crazy things. Just to harken back to the automatic or just to the self-driving cars. The cars we drive now weigh a couple of tons, and we barrel them down the interstate highway at 85 miles per hour, even, you know, over residential areas, you know, in urban settings, and you know, we're with each other. And then, you know, just think of the airlines, a 747, you know, thousands of tons loaded with fuel flying over densely populated areas. So it seems like, you know, maybe we think about that, you know, it would be easy to overstate the danger of that, or at least, or maybe not, maybe we're really not overstating the danger, but maybe we just recognize that we have the capacity to sort of be numbed to the real danger of some of the crazy endeavors that we as humans undertake from time to time, you think?
I will acquiesce to Evan there, because thinking about it, what goes on inside of a Disney park between rides that are industrial machines that could kill you and fireworks that happen every night, pyrotechnics that could fry you if they go wrong. I guess this isn't a huge increase in risk.
No.
By the way, that dragon, that's real fire. That's hot.
Sleeping Beauty, I'm sure, thought so. Let's move on to a privacy story involving the data on your cell phone. So there's an interesting story in the Washington Post this week about systems that track where your cell phone goes, the location data in your cell phone. And this is something that governments have been able to do for some time. I read this story and I get really angry about the fact that governments can do this. And now there are going to be businesses that for a high price will sell you technology that can do this. But if you want to do it yourself, you know, if you want to have some usable way of getting this data and putting it to good use for your family, you know, we're still, I think, miles away from having good systems for that. But Padre, you went to Black Hat and DEF CON this year, and I think have some thoughts about your cell phone and people getting your location data from it.
It is comically easy. It's I was actually sitting with Brian Chi, who is my co-host for This Week in Enterprise Tech, Cyberdog, who's another member of the Twit Army, and one of the engineers I work with at Interop. And we were just working on an encryption project that's a part of the contest for DEF CON. And a street magician comes up and starts a conversation with one of the members of our party. And it's one of those, okay, I'm gonna pull a card out of here. You have to remember what you see on the card. And he gets it wrong and, you know, all this bumbling and so on and so forth. And then Cyberdog's phone rings and it's the card. The card has shown up on his phone. It's because he was able to, with a very small radio that he was carrying in his chest pocket, to get the IMEI of the device. He was able to make it think that it was the antenna tower it should connect to. And then he was able to send it a message. It's that simple. I mean, I got the hardware downstairs to do this. I wouldn't do it because it's illegal, but if you have a larger system, I could track where every phone is at DEF CON. That is trivial. I could do it from my laptop without setting anything up because all the architecture is already built into the convention center. Now, to go up to a city level, I need a few more resources, but not that many more resources. So all it takes is money. And you've got an off-the-shelf plug-and-play system to track everyone who has a device with an IMEI. It's kind of scary, actually.
It's very scary. So, aside from governments and now commercial enterprises that will sell you this kind of data, what are we going to do about it?
Well, you can't. I mean, this data is out in the open. It's mm-hmm. It's not classified. Anybody, if you are a corporation who's looking to do location-based product placement, you can buy this data from phone companies. It's available for sale. It's not illegal to do it. So that, again, just means it's just money. It used to be something that we would take for granted that a government state could do, but now a corporation can do it, and you don't even have to be that big of a corporation to be able to do it. It goes beyond the kind of scary, and it's now – this is a serious invasion of privacy. I used to go and turn off all my devices when I traveled because I didn't need to use them. I just shut them off. But there's another part of the story, which is IMEI is one of the ways that you get tracked. You get tracked by red light cameras. You get tracked by toll takers on the highway. I get tracked every single time I drive to and from San Francisco because I go over a place that uses FastPass, which is an RFID tag that's attached to my car. So I could be ticked off, but I think I'm kind of leaning towards, it's going to happen. I'm sure nothing bad's going to come of it.
Right. And this is one of those instances where someone might say, well, it's just the metadata that's getting picked up, but that is actually more nefarious than it sounds, isn't it?
Right. Well, think about this. Remember the first time we had a big release of metadata? It was when AOL did their big dump. They thought it was a cool project. This was back, what, in like 2007?
06.
Yes, 2006, 2007. They thought it was an awesome experiment for people to see what kind of correlations they could make with a big chunk of metadata. Nothing that was that actually identified the users. And what they found within a day was that people were able to take the metadata, reverse it, and figure out who it was attached to. So metadata isn't just headers. Metadata does identify people if you have a big enough a set of information. So, like, for example, yeah, it may not even be my phone number. It may only be my IMEI, and no one may be able to correlate my IMEI with me. But watch that IMEI over a length of time, and you know I'm always traveling the same path. You know that I always seem to end up between the brick house and the school that I live in San Francisco. And then combine that with any metadata you get on searches that I'm doing from my phone, and it's very easy to figure out who that IMEI belongs to. And the law has no way to catch up with that right now. We're not even thinking about that.
Well, Michael, what do you think about that? Are we thinking about it? I mean, clearly lawmakers are very attuned, I think, to privacy issues and data protection issues these days. They know it's a big consumer concern. Do you think that they'll be able to chart a course that protects people's identities, protects them from being tracked, and enables our cellular network to continue to function?
Well, I'm very proud to be on the advisory board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and on EPIC also, because I think the answer to this is to join those groups as soon as you can. Privacy is on life support right now.
Yeah.
I used to tell people, if you're really concerned about privacy, take the battery out of your phone when you're not using it, carry a burner phone, you'll be okay. But now it turns out that it's trivial to correlate the use of the burner phone to when the other phone's on and off, and to watch its movements and correlate with that. So one burner phone's not enough now. You need several. You have to use them in random ways and make sure they're never on at the same time, and you have a big gap between turning one off and turning the next one on. Or they're going to correlate that with your movements. So it's really, really tough. It's true that politicians are giving significant lip service to privacy. It's also the case that the NSA reform, at least, has got watered down pretty seriously. And that's the one major piece of privacy legislation we had in Congress this year. And it's thin gruel. So I haven't given up on this, but I'm getting increasingly depressed. And people are absolutely right to be scared, because the government has it all. The corporations have a lot of it and are going to have more of it. And David Brin's book, The Transparent Society, looks smarter and smarter every year, which he's predicted that, you know, we're going to be transparent to people of power. And the only question is, are we going to be transparent? Are they going to be transparent to us in exchange? And he said, you know, we ought to be he argued, it seemed absolutely crazy at the time. He argued we ought to be for full transparency, because that's the only way that the powerful will be transparent. Though those of us without power, he saw we'd already lost. Mm-hmm. And I really am worried more and more every year that he's right. It's not a future I like the look of at all. But right now, privacy is in the worst position it's ever been. It gets worse by the nanosecond. Big data correlations just get around every kind of protection you think you had. Anonymizing is a failure, both mathematically and practically. We are in a really, 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 really bad place.
We're kind of ending on a downer.
You know, and I thought that we would with this discussion. I was ready for this, so I threw in this.
Join EPIC, join EFF, yes. Join CDT, join the ACLU, which has a great digital privacy. I mean, there are people fighting really hard. They're making some progress. It, you know, overall, it's a losing tide at the moment. But, you know, the public wakes up to this stuff slowly. So I don't think people are fully awake to it yet. It's probably going to take 10 years. And the question is, we have so much sunk costs in the current architecture, like the cell phone system, for example, which is very privacy unfriendly, that we decided it costs too much to fix the architecture. Right. So this is a complex problem, because part of it's architectural, part of it's social practices, part of it's law. And a lot of it is the interest of law enforcement and other three-letter agencies that find these technologies really, really useful. And when you talk to people in government, they're really worried about people having virus printers in their garage. Right? If you could start printing, you know, dangerous viruses on an $8,000 machine in your garage, which is likely to be happening in the next decade, they think, well, they got to watch everybody.
Right.
And how are you going to talk them out of that?
Well, I'm just thinking about combining this with the story we heard not too long ago about that. There's a corporation that does mass collection of license plate data from those license plate cameras that they have leased out to various cities. And it made news because just recently that system was used to catch a murderer who had gone from one city to the next. They used the location data, even though he didn't receive a ticket. He was never ticketed, but they had the picture of the license plate in enough locations that even though he wasn't using his cell phone, they were able to track his location. So it's like, as you were saying, do you want to have privacy? Turn off your cell phone, never use the internet. But now it's also never go outside. Don't drive anywhere.
Wear a mask.
Yeah.
you want a good investment? Mask fashions. I've been seeing more and more of them. It's coming. You heard it here first. It's coming.
You did. There's your tip. All right. And I did put in a unicorn chaser for this discussion, sensing that it might need one. Or I don't know, maybe it just makes matters worse. It's actually not a unicorn chaser. It's more like a dog chaser with GoPro making a fetch dog mount. We were talking about Justin TV earlier. It's Justin TV for your dog. You put a little mount on your dog. It's carrying around a GoPro and it's you know, sold as, you know, make your dog a cinematographer. Photographer, and but it's also making your dog watch whatever is around your dog. So if you're not already feeling the surveillance of all the various cameras in your world, look out for everyone's dog toting a GoPro. Maybe this would only happen in California, maybe only Southern California, where everyone seems to have a GoPro attached to sticks. Oh my goodness, I was just down in San Diego. And everyone walking down the beach had a GoPro on a stick. Hello, here I am on vacation. I've got my GoPro on a stick. So now, you know, your dog can do that duty for you. Evan, you going to be signing up for one of these things for Christmas?
Well, no. I mean, you got to like this technology. It's really it's fun and it's great part on it's a great on the part of GoPro. I think there's a real niche for it because people certainly will buy these things. But I read something recently about some folks who did a science putting these kinds of cameras. I mean, obviously much more sophisticated on sharks, and there were some really interesting things. I think there was some Japanese scientists who did this and just had captured some footage underwater of sharks in certain environments, seeing different species of sharks interacting with one another in ways that they didn't know about before. So the concept has many more applications other than just the novelty niche for it. But pretty cool stuff. And yeah, I guess we could talk about the privacy things too, but haven't we had enough doom and gloom about that?
So I have one of these in my office. Okay, I have one. And what's really depressing is how few students ever mention this camera pointed at them.
Ah,
they're used to it.
If they do, I tell them, hey, it's a fake. It's a consciousness riser. I don't think they know it's a dummy. I think they're used to it. It's terrible.
They got cameras in their phones. They're everywhere. They people now are conditioned to believe you're always being filmed. And I hate being filmed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's, I see my son and his friends, and what they do notice the cameras in their environment, and they ham it up for them. They, do terrible, dastardly performances, hoping that somewhere, someone will see it and be entertained or appalled.
We'll have gold. Yeah,
might as well.
Yes.
It's probably a tort to put silly string on somebody else's camera.
It probably is.
Find out.
All right, let's end with some law and policy. Padre, we're getting down to the wire here on time. Which would you rather discuss, net neutrality or cell phone kill switches?
Ooh, I just went on a major rant on net neutrality, so maybe we shouldn't do that. That will take me too long. I'm still kind of boiling from that.
Yes, just in passing to note that the FCC has extended its September deadline for net neutrality reply comments, so you still have time to get in and have your voice be heard. It's obviously still a very hot button issue, and you should listen to Padre's rant for more on the nuances of that. But let's talk about California's new smartphone kill switch bill that just got signed into law. This is something that stems from data that came out of, I think, the NYPD, a statistic on stolen phones, how many phones got stolen, and how we really need to be able to not wipe them, but lock them in the event of theft. Well, California has decided, yes, we so need to be doing that, that we're going to mandate it for cell phone manufacturers. It only is going to apply to smartphones. It's not going to apply to tablets or other mobile devices such as hotspots, feature phones, et cetera. And it's not going to go into law until almost a year from now, July 1st, next year, 2015. So Padre, you're in California with me. Do you think that this was overreaching on the part of our legislators?
Yes, I understand why, though. It's a very good idea. The idea of if thieves know that phones can't be used, can't be sold once they're stolen, then we'll probably see the crime rate go down. The legal kludge that's being used on this, I don't think is going to end well, because it's not just, you can't just say, okay, now there's a kill switch on it. If you're going to put a kill switch on a phone, it means that you need to be able to have a way to disable all functions of the phone. That's what the law says. So no emergency calls, no nothing. It also means that you have to have a combination of hardware and software that cannot be defeated in any way, shape, or form. You cannot replace the operating system, because if you're allowed to replace the operating system of a phone, you disable this kill switch. So, you know, it sounds like a great idea, but I think the unintended consequences for this are going to be great. We're going to see carriers use this as a reason why they're not going to allow their users to unlock their phones. We're going to see carriers use this as a reason why, oh, you can't upload the newest firmware because it hasn't yet met the criteria for California's kill switch law. And then there's the regular concerns, which is that this is going to be abused by hackers. It's going to be abused by jilted lovers who have access to your phone account, and it will be abused by the government. But a nice idea. I don't think it's good, though.
It seems to me like kind of a silly idea that, you know, obviously there is huge competition in the smartphone market. And if you as a consumer are concerned about being able to wipe your phone or not even wipe it, just disable access to it after it's been stolen, you're going to buy one that has that functionality built in. I don't know why we need to legislate it necessarily. Michael, do you have a different take?
No, I think he hit it out of the park there.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. That makes me feel good. I did well on my law school exam. Evan, any thoughts?
No, I mean, predictably, you can think I'll agree with you on that. I mean, good grief, let the market play its role here. If it's better for a consumer to purchase one of these phones because they know that it's going to contain theft deterrent hardware software combinations, then, you know, that's going to sell better. And that's what's, just look at general principles of market economics to know that that's what's going to happen there. It's just another garden variety example of over regulation, which is not going to be good for consumers in another respect, because for two reasons, and this theme comes up a lot, it's going to increase the prices of phones because of the, you know, required mandatory stuff that has to go into it. And conversely, and the same thing, just sort of the flip side of that, it may have the effect of stifling innovation. Now, I know Apple has more money than the kingdom of God, right, Padre? Or I don't know if you see the books for your boss's books, but maybe it's, you know, having this stuff mandated is not going to stifle Apple's innovation. But what about the upstarts and this in, it's just another example of the dozens of hoops you got to jump through to do business in California. They don't have to jump through anywhere else. That's just going to add to the costs of innovation, raise the barrier of entry.
People still innovate in California. You know, it's funny. People keep singing this song about how terrible all that law is, and yet there it is, that the tech hub in this country. It can't be that bad.
That's the same argument that the RIAA makes about,
I've been insulted.
They're saying, well, we would have sold even more music had there not been piracy. So, you know, it's just think about how much better it could be in California And Professor, seriously, to take it away from being tongue in cheek, that people still innovate in California, but California sort of becomes the de facto federal standard. Then, you know, if you've got anybody selling phones, well, they're going to be selling them in California, right? So they're going to have to do the same thing if they're selling them in Nebraska. So it's really not just the fact of it influencing California. It becomes the de facto standard for everywhere, and so the barrier to entry is raised. Raised everywhere. So just, yeah, but you know,
it's worked out better for us more often than not. I mean, certainly pollution, for example, emissions, stuff like that. So, I mean, you're right. But that's on balance, it's been a good thing. This may not be an example of it.
I guess. I mean, we don't have any other thing to compare. We don't have any living in a counterfactual universe to have compared it to anything else, but we'll leave it at that.
All right, and we need to drop a second MCLE passphrase into the episode. I think we'll make it brick phone. since I miss my old brick phone, I always wind up wishing I had held on to those old legacy technologies. I'm sure someday I'll wish I'd hung on to my car that I could drive myself because I get nostalgic for them. I miss them, and I miss my old brick phone. I just would like to have it here as a paperweight on my desk. So.
We are coming to that point where we're going to cycle around and that whole retro look is going to be famous again. And the people who have their brick phones are going to just look cool.
I know. Absolutely. Case in point, Guardians of the Galaxy and the Walkman.
Have you seen that? So we've got a couple people here who are trying to build a sort of a retro Walkman to fit the Guardians of the Galaxy. The price of a Sony Walkman on eBay has gone up from about $4 to like $4,000.
Oh, you're kidding me. $4,000?
It's horrible.
Oh, my God. From one movie. Well... We're merely flawed humans. Maybe when the robots take over, we'll make better decisions, or they will. Let's move on to our tip and resource of the week. Our resource is the listicle that Evan teased last week about things to know about trademark. Evan, can you give us the high points of that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I wrote this for my firm blog over at infolawgroup.com. Just sort of a easy read, hopefully, about some very basic things that you should know about trademarks geared toward, business owners, decision makers in the marketing department. Just some real basic stuff about, you know, what trademark law is compared to other forms of intellectual property. It protects the brand. It addresses this problem of descriptive phrases. You know, a lot of companies really want a descriptive term to use as a trademark. Well, that often doesn't work as a trademark because it's not distinctive in the way that it tells the consuming public about the source of the goods or services. So yeah, just take a look at that. It's hopefully an easy read over at infolawgroup.com. That's my firm.
It is. It's great stuff to know about trademarks. It is very straightforward and digestible and includes the heading Trademark Fair Use is a Thing. So in case you didn't know, now you do. And you'll know a lot more if you go check out Evan's piece. Our tip of the week is know your traffic lights. And no, I am not talking once again about self-driving cars or otherwise. I'm talking about DC attorney Mike Meyer, who got pretty royally taken down by Cory Doctorow over on Boing Boing from his use of the DMCA. We were talking about all of the DMCA requests that Google gets and how it would be interesting to find out how many of them were bogus. Cory makes a strong argument here for lawyer Mike Meyer submitting some bogus ones, complaining about critique of him having sort of switched teams. He used to work for EFF or with EFF, and now on the copyright troll defense front, and now he's actually representing people who are out there enforcing their copyrights and trademarks and things. And somebody did some commentary about sort of switching teams, and Mr. Meyer didn't like it and alleged that not only were the screenshots that were used to portray his team switching copyrighted, but also potentially defamatory, which really doesn't have anything to do with the DMCA, didn't stop him from putting that kind of assertion in his takedown request. So if you are a lawyer, and if you are an internet lawyer in particular, know your DMCA before you go firing off takedown requests. As Corey points out, the Streisand effect is real. Here we are talking about this story as well. You don't want to be that guy who is the internet lawyer who filed and signed under penalty of perjury the bogus DMCA takedown request. So, Evan, any thoughts on this?
You know, it's just a shame to see people make bad decisions as a response to having made a bad decision. So, you know, you got to feel for this guy. He's just trying to get by. Actually, I don't feel for the guy. He made some bad decisions. We should be talking bad about him. So, you know,
yeah.
But it's just you see this a lot in the practice law, and it really is, in my opinion, something that really does give the practice of law sort of a bad. It makes people have a bad sense of lawyers because of, you know, switching sides is not cool. It smacks of opportunism and being disingenuous with the public. You know, just doing an about face like this. So it's good that the errors of his ways are being brought to light here, because hopefully that will gives us an opportunity to remind people that not all lawyers are like this. Some of them are actually cool, like you, Denise.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that comment. And it also makes me, you know, I think it's just educational that people who practice internet law, you know, we talked about Google getting a takedown request every 8 milliseconds, and that even people who practice law in this area might not cross all their T's and dot all their I's. I'm not saying, you know, that that's what happened here, but it certainly looks like there's a pretty good argument that this stuff is not subject to takedown, that it's not infringing. There are reasons why it should be up there, and that the DMCA is not the way to go about getting it down. Michael, do you think that, I mean, is this a comment on, obviously the DMCA has so many benefits and is so helpful to sites on the one hand, but again, enlisting every human on the earth to review all your takedown requests does seem like a difficult structure to implement.
Well, I mean, the DMCA has all kinds of flaws, and here's another one.
Yeah.
You know, I've never liked it. I even hate teaching it, but you have to, because it's a big piece of the landscape. I want to give you my tip of the week.
Sure,
Read Evan Brown's blog on internet law cases. It's great. I've been reading it for a long time.
It is.
Oh, thank you.
It's one of our favorites. Evan blogs at internetcases.com and finds the time to actually post substantive analyses of new and really interesting developments, too. It's the curation, Evan, that you do. You always pick great cases to write about and analyze. So we definitely appreciate your efforts. I know it's not easy to make the time to do it.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate the plug. It's fun to
do. All right. Well, this show has been inordinately fun to do. I'm so glad that you all were able to take the time and join us today. Michael Frumkin, such a pleasure to meet you and get to chat. I know that you're a busy guy and the fall term. Is it started yet or imminently starting?
It's been going 2 weeks. I've even finished the first case.
Oh, my gosh. So good. And your students are so fortunate to have such a great professor to learn from. Is there anything going on? We know WeRobot is in our future. Anything else going on at University of Miami that you want to plug before we go ahead and get out of here?
Well, WeRobot's going to be at the University of Washington this year.
Right.
It's going to be April 10th to 11th. I have an online law journal I run called jotwell.com, which is about the latest legal writing. And we're having a conference here in a couple months. So if you go to jotwell.com, you can learn all about that. I guess that's the other thing I should plug.
Very cool. We will follow along with
both
of those.
Man, that was quick. That's impressive.
Yes, that was quick. Padre SJ, the digital Jesuit, we are so thrilled that you could join us today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Friday.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It's always fun to be on this show. You get to talk about a lot of the stuff that I would love to talk to on my shows, but it just doesn't quite fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. We always get mission creep critiques, I think, on both of our shows. We like to talk about robots, and we struggle to find the legal angle. Fortunately, it's not hard to find. I think you like to talk about legal things, and your audience says, hey, what does this have to do with, you know, implementing my security program?
It's exactly. Always like, but the law's yes. Cool. Come on, fun. The law. Enterprise people love the law.
They think root yeah. canal.
Yes.
Or theft.
But no, thank you. Thank one you very much. And thank you both for being on Twiat a few weeks back. We will do that again because it's always nice to be able to clear out the legal docket. We like to save up some of the legal heavy stories because we can give our opinions, but it's always nice to get people who are actually in the know.
Sure. We'd love to come back sometime soon. Thanks for the offer. All right, folks, we really appreciate your tuning in with us. It is a Friday morning, and we started this show at 11 o'clock Pacific time. Well, it's no longer morning. 1800 UTC is when we start. So if you like to watch live along with us, that's the time you should put in your calendar. But you don't need to schedule your life around us. We appreciate it when you do, but you certainly don't have to. You can get this show on demand and after the fact by going to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows is available there. If YouTube is your poison of choice, go over to youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. You can watch us there too. We're on iTunes. We're on Roku, various other sources. I'm sure that you've got this all covered, but we're just glad that you watch however you choose to do so. You should get in touch with us between the shows too, because that's how we get some of our best ideas for guests and stories. I am D. Howell on Twitter. Evan is Internet Cases there, same name as his blog. Or you can email us. He is evan@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. Or find us on Facebook or Google+. If you have more to say and want to get into a lengthier discussion, those are good places to do that. We've really enjoyed being with you, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law.